play tonight in Cincinnati. Northwoods League Baseball, the first game of the Kenosha Kingfish Lakeshore Chinooks doubleheader rained out in Kenosha yesterday afternoon. Kingfish won the second game in Mequon last night, 3-1. The Kingfish play the Green Bay Bullfrogs at 7:05 tonight at Simmons. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny and hot today, a high of 87. Now 73 in Racine, 76 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from UW Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. A new book has just been published that, in fact, is not a new book at all, but actually a book that was written back in 1931 by a gifted woman and scholar by the name of Zola Neale Hurston. It was a book, or it was hoped to be a book, called Barracoon, telling the true story of one Cujo Lewis, an elderly African-American man living in Alabama who was widely believed to be the very last African to be captured in Africa and brought to America as a slave. His story was extraordinary, but for one reason or another, no publisher could be found to publish this book and share it with the public. The manuscript languished in deep obscurity for decades, and it has now been brought before the public at last, published by Amistad as Barracoon, the Story of the Last Black Cargo. And one of the people who has been quite active in helping to bring this work at last to the world is Deborah G. Plant, an African-American literature scholar and a history scholar whose specialty is really the works of Zola Neale Hurston, who is responsible for several different books, including probably best known, Their Eyes Were Watching God. But of course, the world is very, very excited to finally have Barracoon, the Story of the Last Black Cargo. So the author, Zora Neale Hurston, the book edited by my morning show guest, Deborah G. Plant. Deborah G. Plant, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm really pleased to be here.
Well, thank you for making time for this in your schedule. It's such an interesting story on several different levels. The story of this man, Cujo Lewis, the story of this manuscript, the story of Zola Neale Hurston. Let's actually begin with the last at the start. Tell us about your initial encounter with Zora Neale Hurston and what made her and her work so compelling to you, even apart from the specific book that we will eventually start talking about today.
Well, you might have to stop me if I go on too long, because the reason for my, why Hurston, and that's Zora with an R, Zora Neale Hurston, why she is so compelling an author for me is because she was one of the first writers who I read who captured that Black Southern life in such a way that when I read her work, I saw myself in it. And I had read the works of several other African-American artists, writers, and their work was compelling as well, but no one really captured the culture and the speech and the behavior, the behavioral patterns and all of those kinds of things that make up a people. No one really captured that for me the way Zora Hurston did. So I found it was like looking in a mirror when I read her. And so, and the first book I read, like with many others, was Their Eyes Were Watching God, but it kept me coming back to Hurston. And
that,
so I did.
That's a novel that she wrote, I think, in 1937. And I think when I was thinking about her, I was not fully appreciative of the fact that what she mostly did was write fiction. Four novels and quite a number of short stories, plays, even essays. And it is into these works of fiction that she poured this, well, what I guess we could maybe call it an authentic voice. I mean, in which she was writing in a way that for you and for many, many other readers was bracingly, refreshingly real.
Yes, yes. Yes, exactly. And in her day, on the one hand, she was praised and lauded for that. And then, on the other hand, she was also criticized for it. For some critics, they felt that she was carrying on the minstrelsy tradition, the minstrel tradition that made fun of African Americans and that belittled them and, you know, had them appear buffoonish and whatnot. But what Hurston was doing was so separate from that. So different from that. And what she was doing was, as you pointed out earlier, she was bringing that authentic aspect of our culture into print and also on the stage as well, because she was quite a dramatist as well. So where those who were basically using our culture as something to poke fun at, something to laugh about, something that basically perpetuated stereotypes, and some of those stereotypes are still around today. But this, that was inauthentic. That was dehumanizing. But what she was doing was actually, through her depiction of African-American, the African-American folk, she was showing actually the humanity of African-American folk and how that was expressed through their speech patterns, through the various kinds of linguistic expressions, stories and sermons and things of that nature. So she was, as you said earlier, bringing that authentic aspect of our culture to light.
I have read that Zora Neale Hurston was part of what has come to be known as the Harlem Renaissance. Can we just take a few moments for you to explain to our listeners what the Harlem Renaissance was really all about, and how she would be, that is Zora Neale Hurston, a good example of the kind of artists who came to prominence during the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, the Harlem Renaissance is a cultural movement that basically sought to bring African Americans into the modern era. And much of what they were trying to do was hinged on cultural production. That is, through cultural products, whether they are novels or art, visual art, sculpting or painting or song or what have you, that through these cultural venues that they could showcase who we were. And one of the major aspects of showcasing who we were as African American peoples was to really present that part of our culture which was specifically recognizably African. And it was to say that we had our own cultural expressions, and they were rooted in the history and the traditions, the customs of our roots, which is Africa. So to see African Americans as a people with their own arts, their own language, their own history, their own intellectual ideas in the world, and to see that the source was African was to say also that we also bring something to the table. We also bring something to American society. Mm. And what we bring is also part of our heritage, which is African. Mm. And so Hurston, one of the main reasons that she was so essential to this movement was she was one of few African Americans who were I would say not only trained in recognizing cultural aspects and the African aspects of that culture, but she also was born and reared in the South, which is basically where the Harlem Renaissance pundits saw that it was to the folk, and specifically folk in the South, who maintained that heritage. And Hurston was the one who knew how to recognize it, how to assess it, how to present it. And so being trained as a cultural anthropologist who was also trained in ethnography, folklore collecting, and things of that nature, then she was truly instrumental to the objectives of the Harlem Renaissance movement. Hmm.
How popular was she at the height of her career, which I think was the 1930s? I mean, was she writing books that were widely read? And also, in a sense, what was her audience? I mean, was she writing primarily for a black audience? Was it mostly blacks who were reading her works, or did they have wider dissemination than that?
The dissemination had to be wider, mainly because literacy rates were not quite that high for African-American peoples. There were those who were literate and who could read, but there were those who had to be read, too. And this is part of it as well, because she would talk about traveling through the South and reading to people from the works of her friend Langston Hughes, and she said, I read your poems, and they just really loved them, and that kind of thing. But in relation to Hurston herself, of course, she wrote for African, not specifically for African Americans. She wrote, I think, for posterity. But her audience would have been those African Americans who were literate, and also those whites who were interested in African American culture and society, and she was quite popular. She was the most known black writer of her day, and the most prolific. So, and during the 30s, well, we have Jonas Gorevine, 1934, and then Their Eyes Were Watching God, 1937. And then Muse and Men, not Muse and Men, but Moses, Man of the Mountain, in 1938. So in the 30s, and this is during, the Great Depression, but this is when she was at her height in terms of publication, and so she was widely known, and initially well received. And when I say that, I'm speaking particularly in relation to the black readership and the leadership of African Americans at that time, who, when she began to write and she began to give us these stories about the African American folk and giving us their stories in their own language, in the idioms and the dialect of their own language, this was considered, a wonderful gift, a wonderful literary gift, and then she continued to do what she was doing, and over time, this was seen as, as I said before, as something negative, as something to be criticized, as something that she ought to stop doing, which she didn't. So, but before that, she was quite esteemed as an author.
Mm.
And of course, we know that changed because by the time she died, all of her books were out of print.
Right. And of course, by the very end of her career and by her death in 1960, she had really, from the sounds of it, fallen into obscurity and was dealing with some financial difficulties and health difficulties. It's sad to see that. It is the great Alice Walker who wrote the beautiful foreword for this new book, Barracoon, who really helped revive interest in Zora Neale Hurston. Just say a quick word about what Alice Walker did and how the world came to, in a sense, rediscover Hurston and her work.
Well, first of all, before I get to Walker, I just want to say that, you know, much is made of Hurston's last days as being somehow obscure and difficult and whatnot, and that's not to deny the fact that we would like to have had better circumstances. But at the same time, you know, a sun that rises also must set. And during those last days, Hurston was still writing. And simply because one is not being published doesn't mean one is not writing.
Hmm.
And she continued to write almost up until her death. And this was very important to her because she said that, you know, my work is everything to me, and without my work, I go to pieces. And we know that she still had her work, and she still had people who valued what she was doing. And she had the great fortune, actually, to live in a community. Her last years were spent in Fort Pierce, Florida, but that community, they embraced her and they took care of her. And so I think we need to bring that light to, you know, those years, because they weren't as dark and dreadful as you know, the discourse has it.
Hmm.
In any case, yes, she did go into obscurity mainly because her books were no longer published and she had not become part of the literary canon. So, you know, it stands to reason that we wouldn't know who she was. But that being said, Alice Walker, in her own writing, was looking for some specific kinds of work in relation to the traditions of hoodoo and voodoo and that kind of thing, and the customs of the folk and folklore, black folklore. And when she looked for that, long story short, she happened to find Zora Neale Hurston's work. And you know, she went through some really stereotypical kinds of writings that really were disappointing to her. And then she discovered Zora Neale Hurston's Muse and Men. And Muse and Men is one of the books that she says, you know, if she were on an island and she had, you know, two books to read, Muse and Men would be one and Their Eyes Were Watching God would be the other.
Wow.
So, so Hurston became, you know, this wonderful influence in her life, and not only in terms of the writing and the folklore that Hurston had collected and was able to gift us with, but also she was a writer. And Walker, as a young writer who was also African American and also female, had precious few examples of what that looked like and how one went about being a black woman writer in America. And so Herson set that example for her and, you know, became the literary foremother that she has become for so many of us. And not having learned about Herson in school because she wasn't being taught, not having any of her books before trying to find them on her own, she wanted to know more about this literary ancestor. And so she went about the business of trying to find out more about her, and that led her on her search, which she wrote an article about, and which was published in Ms. Magazine, titled, you know, Looking for Zora. And so that search took her from Edenville to Fort Pierce and parts in between to rediscover this foremother who had been, yes, lost to obscurity and what have you. And when she, one of the very profound things that Alice Walker did when she discovered where the gravesite was at the Heavenly Rest Cemetery in Fort Pierce, she had a headstone erected at that site. Hmm. And so now we know where, at least we are in the right vicinity in terms of where her body was laid to rest. And we have Alice Walker to thank for that.
Hmm. So it is an unmarked grave no longer. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Deborah G. Plant, who is a African-American literature scholar, history scholar, and her specialty is the work of Zora Neale Hurston, a very gifted writer who created a number of different important works of fiction, including four novels. And the reason for this conversation today is because of the very recent publication of yet another work by Zora Neale Hurston that was never published during her lifetime and scarcely even known of during her lifetime, a book called Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo. And Deborah G. Plant is the editor for this important book published by Amistad. Deborah G. Plant, what can you tell us about how Zora Neale Hurston found this man named Cujo Lewis, believed to be the last African sold as a slave, transported to North America. How did the two of them end up crossing paths? Do we know?
Yes, we do. And the beginning of that was Hurston's work with Dr. Carter G. Woodson and Dr. Franz Boas. They sent her into the field to do some collecting, and also for Dr. Woodson to collect Kosala's story. Kosala is Cujo Lewis's African name. And so she basically went there on behalf of Dr. Carter G. Woodson. And that was in 1927, so she collected his story and some other materials that helped to contextualize his story, and gave those her papers about that, her report on that, to Dr. Woodson. But apparently she felt that there was more to learn from him and more to know about him and his story. So she returned in later 1927, around December, and then again in 1928, where she spent the bulk of her time with Cujo Lewis, also Kosala. And there, during that time, she began to listen to him. She said, "You have this history of being captured, of being transported through the Middle Passage into Alabama. You've lived through the Civil War, emancipation, Jim Crow, all of these world events. And she says, I want to know about you, and I want to know who you are. And he consented to talk with her. I mean, he had talked with others before. He had been interviewed many times, but only Zora Neale Hurston stayed for the full length of Khosla's story. And this is how she initiated her writing, this narrative.
Hmm. We are told that that their encounters, you know, day after day would vary quite wildly, in that there would be days when he would be very talkative, and other days when, for one reason or another, he was largely unwilling or maybe unable to share his stories. And it sounds like she had to be kind of persistent and patient and sometimes cajole these stories out of him. Can you tell us a little more about the relationship between the two of them and just how hard Zora Neale Hurston worked to get as much as she possibly could from Cujo Lewis?
Well, I wouldn't really, I don't know that I would characterize it as working hard so much as she was just committed to his story and the history that his story brought. And you're right, it was, he didn't just sit there, you know, from one day to the next and let her interview him. He was 86 years old when she asked him to talk with her and allow her to write his story down. And he was, he also had his life to live. He had to mend his fence. He had to go into town to do things. He had to take care of his task at the church. He was the sexton at the church. He had to tend to whatever his crops were at the time. And so he would accommodate her, but he also had his moods as well. And sometimes he just didn't feel like talking, or he wasn't, or he just, his mind was on something else. And sometimes, as she tells us in the narrative, he was, they would be talking, and he would just be so wrapped in his memories that she felt compelled to leave him to his memories, and she would come back another time. But she was thoroughly committed, not only to the story, but also to Khosla. She was committed to him, which meant that when, you know, he had to do something at the church, and he didn't want to talk that day, she would help him. You know, he would say, you know, I told you I have to clean the church on Saturday. Saturday I have to go clean the church, and why are you here? And she would say, it's okay, Khosla or Cujo Lewis. I will help you. And then he would let her come and help. And sometimes, like I said, he needed to go into town, and she would like, well, I'll take you. And sometimes he requested her to come and take him into town. I need to go into the Mobile. And she said, okay. And so in this way of also accommodating him and respecting his feelings and respecting the fact that he didn't want to talk all the time, and that what they were talking about was really traumatic for him.
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the things we should probably explore here just a bit. And I think one of the things that's especially important about the story of Cujo Lewis as it's told in this book, Berekun, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, is that even for someone, and of course I think any civilized human being is horrified the specter of slavery and the thought of somebody being wrenched away from everything familiar to them and transported across the ocean to a strange place to be a slave. I mean, it's horrifying, abhorrent on every level. But that doesn't mean that we have given much thought to what life was like for these people in Africa before they were captured and sold and transported away. And we learn at least something about the life of this man in Africa, and then the circumstances under which he was captured and sold into slavery. What do you think is most intriguing about the early life of this man in Africa before his capture?
Well, I think for me, what's intriguing is how he talks about his hometown, which is called Bante in West Africa, and his family. His mother was an Orisha devotee, and his father did agricultural work as his grandfather too, but his grandfather also was an assistant to the king, and he loved his life. He loved the customs and the traditions, and you know, he thrilled when he talked about becoming a young man and going through the rituals of becoming a young man and learning how to camp and learning how to hunt and learning how to defend his village. And he tells us about, you know, looking at a girl and smiling and telling his parents, like, when you see her, you be nice to her. And so they began to, go through the customs that would be necessary for his marriage. And, of course, we know that that never happened. But it speaks to the harmony of his society. And his particular village was Yoruba, and an Isha Yoruba. And the people of his village were a peaceful people. And, of course, we know that not all villages and not all ethnic groups were peaceful people. Many were bellicose, like those who, amongst the Daomians, who raided his village. But prior to that, there was this harmony, this coherence, this groundedness in spirit and in order and what have you. And so I think that tells us a lot about him and a lot about human society in early Africa. And of course, that was all of that. He was uprooted from that. But this is what preceded it. And I think that because it was such a powerful part of his life, that his memory of that, I believe, is what sustained him through the hardship, the heartbreak, the uprooting, the starting over, the hostilities in America. I think this is what sustained him. And so, you know, this memory of his parents, his grandparents, his community, his customs, their traditions, all of these aspects of his culture, they on one level or another continued in America. You know, we know that he and his compatriots really maintained so much of their culture that they created Africatown, which is, you know, the community that it still exists today. But they founded that town, well, that community, but it's called Africatown. It was never incorporated, but it's because they revered their customs so much, and they wanted to maintain them to the extent that they could, even as they were acculturating into African-American and American society and culture.
Mm.
So I think the beauty of his culture and traditions and customs and the way that they had him be and feel empowered and powerful in Bonte, and how that really sustained him in America.
Mm-hmm. He is captured and sold into slavery, in a sense, at a time when this was largely illegal, and illegal as far as Great Britain was concerned and as far as America was concerned. Not that slavery was prohibited in the United States at that time, but in a sense, the slave trade was prohibited, if I understand correctly.
Yes,
so
yes.
So the capture and selling and transporting of slaves by this time, which is 1860, is in a sense done completely underground. And what is, of course, especially horrifying is the complicity of certain Africans who were a part of these efforts. Can you just explain how such an inconceivable thing could in fact be true?
Well, the thing of it is that it's not particularly horrifying because other quote-unquote Africans participated in this, you know, inhumane enterprise. It's horrifying because it happened at all. And it's only, you know, from the perspective of the 20th century that we have a sense of everybody on the African continent as Africans. They were not. They were Fon or Yoruba or Fulani or whatever particular ethnic group that one came from, or whatever particular religious culture one came from. This is how people identified themselves, not as Africans. That was imposed upon them from without. And, of course, the whole business of European colonialism, you know, just sort of created this narrative where everyone on the continent becomes African. But that wasn't true then, and even though many of us will accept that today, it's still not true today. People identify in very specific kinds of ways. So it's not so much that other Africans did that. The people who did that were people who were just like Timothy Mayer and William Foster. They had a kinship, and it's called greed and glory.
Mm-hmm.
And Hurston talks about that, you know, in her autobiography, because she had to be disabused of that notion too, that Africans, you know, were stolen out of Africa, and you know, and Europeans were the ones who were guilty in all of this. And she learned that, oh, these quote-unquote other Africans, they were actually Daomians or the Fon people. You know, they were the ones in relation to Khosla who committed that atrocity. And so as she saw that there was this collaboration between Europeans, Africans, quote-unquote Africans, and Americans, what have you, when she saw that they worked, you know, collaboratively to undertake these enterprises, and she says it showed her the universal nature of greed and glory.
Hmm.
And that was the problem. That was the horror, was that any human being could do that to any human being.
Of course. So, and, you know, it's interesting. Yeah. In a way, it almost underscores the humanity that we all share. And
yeah.
And of course we tend to think about that typically in only positive terms. But the dark side, the sinful side, if you will, of human beings is also something that we all share. There's nothing uniquely American or uniquely European or uniquely African about some of these impulses. They reside in all of us. And in a strange way, there is something of the story of our shared humanity that's also part of this. At any rate, Cujo Lewis is captured, sees terrible atrocities in the course of being captured, is transported to America, sold into slavery in Alabama, and is a slave for 5 years. Explain the circumstances under which he became a slave no longer.
Well, basically, the Civil War ended that, and he talks about it in his narrative when he shares that he was working on a steamboat, and Timothy Mayer and his brothers had several steamboats, and Kosala worked on one of them. And I believe they were loading or unloading these whatever from the boat, and Union soldiers came by, and they told them, like, you know, you all can go now. You're free. You've been freed, and so it was the result of you know, the Civil War and these soldiers telling them that you're free, and telling them that they were free was very important, because as we know, some enslaved people, like those in Texas, never found out until way later, and which is why yesterday was being celebrated as Juneteenth Day, because no one told them. And the same thing with Cujo Lewis. He was freed, I would say, again when the Union soldiers told him this, because they were actually freed in 1863. They were emancipated. Those in the Confederate States were freed. And this was part of Lincoln's plan to undo what, you know, the Southern states were trying to do in terms of pulling out of the Union. And so freeing the enslaved in the Confederate States was part of that in 1863. But they didn't get the word, just like no one bothered to tell Kosala anything. And finally, though, when the Union soldiers win the war, they do enforce the Emancipation Proclamation Act and let everyone know that they're free. So he was told that he was free. And so he and those with him, you know, they didn't quite know what to do. So they would be told, well, go here to this house or this place, and you'll be given some kind of direction. And but this is that those were the circumstances. And so we could go on from there, but let me know where you want us to go from there.
Right. No, I think we want to leave it to our listeners to explore the rest of Cujo Lewis's story, his life, his many experiences through, of course, the years of Reconstruction into the early 20th century. It's kind of staggering to think of how the world continued to change through the course of his life. Let's finish by talking about the book itself and in a sense, what it is and what it isn't. Zora Neale Hurston's preface includes right at the top these words, that the book you're about to read makes no attempt to be a scientific document. Explain what this book really is, and maybe along the way then help us understand why no publisher seemed to be interested in what, of course, now we regard as an extraordinary work.
We have to remember that Hurston was a social scientist. And part of being a social scientist, as she was trained by Franz Boas, who was, you know, the father of American anthropology, part of it was using historical documentation to contextualize a particular story and or a piece of folklore or what have you, and to do it in ways that respected the that particular the methods of cultural anthropology. And so Hurston was not so much interested in creating documents for science that would basically be a part of some journal or book that nobody would ever read. At the same time, Hurston did do the historical work that would contextualize Kosler's story and validate what he was saying. So we know that what he experienced actually happened, and is documented on that level. But basically, I think when she says this is not, you know, a scientific document, I think she's letting us know that she has no interest in trying to follow all of the specific guidelines of that a cultural anthropologist would do for science sake for that academic community. She was less interested in being academic than she was interested in having a story that everyone that would be available to everyone and be presented in a way that everyone could read, which is basically what she did. Now, why wouldn't it be published or publishable in her day? It really was publishable in her day, and we know that certain publishing houses, one in particular, asked for this narrative more than once. But they wanted her to change the language. As they put it, we want to publish your work, but would you rewrite it in language rather than dialect? And she wouldn't change it. She wouldn't do that. So consequently, that publishing house wouldn't accept it. And so why wouldn't other publishers accept it? We don't know, because we don't have that information at this point in time. It may be somewhere, but we have to find that. But we know about one of them, at least. So, but Hurston, because she was a consummate social scientist, and as an ethnographer, she knew the importance of maintaining the language of an informant and keeping it as she heard it, writing it down exactly as she heard it, the pronunciation of it, which, you know, would be presented in the particular dialect, and maintain everything about it that would give it its idiomatic expression. And so she refused to change that, because that was vital to the portrait of Kosler. And in this language, you know, we have this language is history itself. Encoded in the language that he spoke was everything that he experienced. And you know, this is his way, his expression that speaks to his linguistic roots. Also, it speaks to the deracination, the uprooting, the pulling up away from not only his mother tongue, but also his motherland. And all of that information is encoded in his language.
Right. And without that, we would not have his voice with such vibrancy. It's an extraordinary book, and of course it is so good that at long last it is available to the public to explore. The book again is Berikun, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, the life story of one Cujo Lewis. And the woman initially responsible for it, Zora Neale Hurston, and the editor of it, Deborah G. Plant, the book published by Amistad. Deborah G. Plant, I have so enjoyed speaking with you today, and have learned a great deal about this story and about this book. And I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
You're very welcome.